Bianca. Please go ahead and begin. Hey. Hey. Golly. No kidding. If you guys want to keep talking, go outside.
So, good morning. So, I'm Carl Hossifus, General Counsel, Chief Compliance Officer for Treasury.
Hi, I'm Bianca.
She's our Senior Compliance Officer. We're here to give you a brief, kind of what I view as an interim update. Bianca's going to give you an update on our implementation of Aladdin, something that the Council approved a while ago, which just went live about 6 months ago now. And then I'll talk a little bit more about kind of the direction of where we're headed. So.
Well, welcome back. As Carl mentioned, in August 2014, the Council approved funding for Aladdin. Aladdin went live in September 2015. And the reason we implemented it was to improve operations, to improve risk, and also compliance. So today we just wanted to share some of the ways that it's improved compliance. So just to look back first, in 2013, Qatar conducted a peer benchmarking survey. And the survey was on fixed income and compliance. And Oregon ranked 13th. It was tied for last place. Oregon was tied for last place on compliance. So on this chart here, the compliance categories are at the bottom. So supervision and control and management and execution. But we were uniformly tied in last place for on all of the categories. So one of the ways that Aladdin has improved compliance is basically automating processes. This is where we had MNPI, materially non-public information, material non-public information. And previously we would have this just manual, and now through Aladdin it's all automated, as you can see. If you search for Microsoft, you can go back and look at a previous date, and it shows you that, in fact, it is not on the list. So this really reduces risk, compliance risk, non-compliance, because previously everything was manual. So you had to either track your email or remember, and how we were tracking whether there was any restriction, whether there was any training on these restricted portfolio securities was also manual. And now Aladdin stops it both at the portfolio level and at the individual security level. So this is just a snapshot of that. The second area of better of improvement on compliance has just been on governance, and that has improved because originally, for example, for all our external managers on the fixed income, we were relying on the external managers. They would attest and say, yes, we are in compliance, or they have to pass the button and say, yes, we are, and that was quarterly. But we were in, the compliance team wasn't doing any particular monitoring. Same with our fixed income, with the equity team. The equity team, we didn't have the capability to do monitoring in-house. So what we were doing was we were using our custodian, which is State Street Bank, and they have two systems. So they have Charles River Development and MIG21, which is Managing Investment Guidelines in the 21st Century. So they are monitoring our portfolios, about 19 of those, or 30%, on these two systems. And we get the reports from them about 22 days after the end of the month. And that's what we were relying on. We don't have visibility into the systems, and obviously the timing is also such that it's not ideal. So with Aladdin, now we have the capacity to actually do this in-house. So we've gotten three of our portfolios, which is about 30% of assets, now on Aladdin, and the plan is to bring more as we have the resources. And then the third...
I'm sorry, what did you say the percentage was right now?
30.
Okay, thanks.
And the last category is just that Aladdin, it's a very key factor in my view because it's an integrated platform, so it lets us use data from various sources for compliance, which we didn't have the ability to do before. So kind of like Tom mentioned, that it just gives us more tools to be able to use. So one of the things, we have three things. So one thing is the dashboard, which we didn't have before. Anyway, the dashboard,
We have our slides.
We have our slides.
Yeah.
Okay.
So,
well, the slides don't do this stuff, but it's okay.
They don't have the animations.
But if we shake
them, but you can get them. Move them around.
Okay. Well, so previously we didn't have a dashboard at all. In our previous system, there was a compliance board, but now what the dashboard does is it does three things. One, it serves as a compliance monitor. Second, it also lets us document. So if there's a violation, we can document within there, and everyone's looking at the same information. So Tom can look at the same information, Garrett can look at the same information, and we look at the same information. And then also serves as a workflow tool. So we can track, okay, here was the trade, it was entered as an order, now it's been executed, now it's cleared compliance, and everyone can track the same thing. And I think that's really helpful. The second area is tracking error. So I think, Rex, you had asked about what is active risk. So on the equity portfolios, for example, on all the internal portfolios, oh, here is the dashboard. So this is a violation. It's tracking. So here we are recording that whatever the comments. So in this case, the weighted average life was, in fact, okay. So that's what we're recording. And in a minute, you'll see on the left-hand side here. Anyways, on to, yes, it's not working correctly. On tracking errors, so first we had three different systems. We were taking information from, for example, State Street, which is what is showing here on the right-hand side, and then recording it in Excel, and then we had calculated tracking error in Barra 1, which is another system, and we also got information from Bloomberg on futures, and then we had to manually compile the tracking error, and it was a time-consuming and manual process. And now, instead of doing all this, in Aladdin, we have five internal portfolios, each have a tracking error rule, and the performance analytics just is calculated within Aladdin, and it has, for example, 10 bips tracking error on the S&P 400, 50 on the Russell 2000, and so on. So every day, the active risk on the internally managed equity portfolios is calculated within Aladdin, and when it flags, the portfolio managers can see it, and compliance can see it too. So that is an improvement from our previous stage. And then the last thing is just a drill down of looking at the entire portfolio. So here, for example, this is the green package report, which is static, so it refreshes every night. And we can look at just a view of what is, or here it's shown the alternatives. But we can also look at, for example, Tom mentioned that we're looking at a lot of ABS and MBS. So here, if we wanted to go in and look at for fixed income, what is their credit card debt, backed ABS debt, we can look that up, just drill down here. Seems to be a little bit lag, but here, for example, in the core fixed income, it's going to look at one of the portfolios, which is the BlackRock externally managed. And then we can scroll down and look at ABS and then credit cards. And then we can look at the security level detail if we wanted to. And then the last one, this is an interactive view of Prism. So for example, here it's looking at what the allocation is on the fund. This is we can share views also on the dashboard. Everyone can share views. So this is one of the views from Ferrin, actually. And then one of the previous speakers talked about exposure to China is a risk. You know, they're worried about what the leverage is. So here, if we wanted to look at what is the exposure to China, that's at 0.4%. So we can look at, on the entire OST portfolio, both internally managed and externally managed, because now it's on a lab, we can say, okay, if you're worried about China, what's the risk on China? And we can see at a glance that it's 0.4%. So that's all we have on the slides. And then in terms of next steps, one of the things we want to do is obviously expand. We talked about what's the percentage now, so we want to expand from 30% and increase it to 100% because we believe that's a better governance model. The other thing we want to do is figure out how we can continue to use Aladdin better. So we are learning what the tools are, what the data is, and how we can use that to add value. And then the last thing is just refine the frequency and the presentation format.
Thank you, Priyanka. So Aladdin really is a great tool, and what we're trying to do is it takes things that we have to rely on external managers and other people for information or for certification. Verification allows us to bring that in-house and control that and use it in a way, in much more efficient ways internally. So that was the first kind of step forward, not just for OST, because it's done wonders in our own, you know, portfolio management. It's been great for compliance as well. But that was just the first step. So what we're looking at here is kind of a quick interim report to you, and I would intend for compliance to report to you on an annual basis going forward, probably starting at the beginning of next year. So as you know, I came on board in January as kind of the first hire for building out both the legal and compliance group for Oregon State Treasury. We're now up to really two people in our group. You have Priyanka and I. At the same time I came over, we were able to bring over two Department of Justice attorneys, Dina Bethello and Jennifer Peet, who did most of the work within the Department of Justice for the investment division. So we brought both of them in-house. Soon after I came on board, we also hired a paralegal, Kathy Garcia, and we also now have, if you guys want to raise your hands, Kathy, raise your hand. I think the council knows both Jennifer and Dina, but you can both raise your hands as well. And then we had Michelle Weingart return to us. She's our receptionist, but she's also providing some administrative support. But going forward, in terms of hiring, we're looking at this month starting moving forward with, I should say, our first hire, which really fills a vacant compliance position. And then in the third quarter, we'll start moving forward with hiring two new compliance positions, which will start focusing on providing additional compliance support and at the same time focusing on operational due diligence, third-party due diligence, both managers and vendors, and overall risk. So we're looking forward to adding those, probably Q3, and then the end of the year, beginning of next year, those two will be hired. And then we can talk next year about the plans going forward for the next the year following that. In addition to Aladdin, we're moving forward right now. We're two-thirds of the way through an RFP for a compliance management system, which kind of takes kind of a lot of Aladdin things and is focused just more on compliance. That will help us with monitoring and testing our own employees' trading, their internal trading, comparing to what we're doing, comparing it to any sort of information we have that might be material, non-public information. It will allow us to actively monitor and archive certifications from employees, sort of our annual compliance certifications, quarterly certifications, various things like that. And we'll also do a couple other things, hopefully, as we go forward. But overall, over the course of this next year, we'll really start fleshing out the team. The following year after that, I think we'll have pretty much a full team, hopefully, going forward, and we'll really be able to focus more on just the kind of operational risks that compliance has had to focus on just the portfolio level, and we'll be able to broaden that and look more, not just at what we're doing in the portfolio, making sure the portfolios are actually following along the investment policies that the council has set, but also look at what we're doing internally for kind of conflicts of interest, potential risks that we have on an internal basis, as well as externally looking at our third-party managers on a continuing basis and looking at vendors. And if you guys have any questions, feel free to ask them. Also, throughout the year, if you guys have any topics that you'd like legal or compliance to address, feel free to let us know and include in the next report. Any questions? Comments?
I asked about, only look, don't touch, access for OIC members, kind of access for dummies to Aladdin so that we can see how the portfolio is, look at different... But there's not
going to
be that.
Well, that's something we can discuss. That's maybe we can just chat about that offline, probably.
Okay.
That's something we can discuss.
Okay, great.
All right. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Brad.
Okay. You guys are on the hot seat. Girl, Janet. Coming up yet? You're just on your own?
They had too many spicy noodles last night.
They decided to let you go. Okay.
And give them a break today. So, good morning, everyone. So, I'm going to cover the performance report through the first quarter. I'm just going to touch on some highlights. Certainly, if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them. just a little bit of a backdrop before I get into the specific numbers. You know, the adage is that the markets hate uncertainty, and we have a lot of uncertainty around the globe right now. And that really started to manifest itself in the markets back in the summer of last year. A lot of concern about global growth, particularly in the emerging markets, and particularly China. We saw oil drop precipitously, and really the commodity complex as a whole decline. Concern about U.S. interest rates, rising rates, and the path to rising rates. Is that going to happen? When? How? You add to that what's becoming an increasingly tense political environment in the U.S. You add to that increased geopolitical risks around the globe. So you've got a lot of uncertainty, and the markets really have reacted in a very volatile manner, which is probably to be expected when you have that type of uncertainty. The first quarter, as you'll see, is interesting. We joked about this, is that if you went away on New Year's Eve and came back on March 31st, you probably wouldn't think that a whole lot happened when you just look at the numbers, but anything was further from the truth. It was really a tale of two very different periods in the first quarter. The first half of the quarter through about February 11th was a very risk-off period of time. So investors sold off risky assets, equities plunged, credit was poor, and then the markets rebounded sharply in the last part of the quarter. Actually, it eked out some positive gains even in the U.S. equity market. Bonds performed pretty well. So it was really a tale of two very, very different market environments. So let me show you some numbers here. If you turn to page 3 of the Cowen report, which I believe is page 56 of your doc, you can just see the numbers. These are, again, all ended periods, ended March 2016. You can see the S&P eked out a little bit of a gain. It was up 1.4%. It was down 10% at one point and then rallied. A little bit of a different in leadership in the market during the quarter. Last year, if you recall, there was a big theme about technology and certainly large technology. There was an acronym that was coined called FANG, the FANG stocks, Facebook, Amazon, Netflix, and Google. A tremendous performance from those stocks. Facebook had a pretty good quarter, but the other three sold off. So technology wasn't a leader in the markets. Actually, the more defensive sectors of the market performed well. Utilities in particular. So those were the better performing areas of the market. Things like financials and healthcare sold off during them. So there was a little bit of a change in the leadership. As a result of that, value managers did better than growth managers pretty much across the spectrum, whether it was large, mid, or small. And that was a change from last year where growth was definitely the lead. You can see the small cap index, the Russell 2000, was negative. It was down 1.5%. So large cap continued its leadership there. And when you look out at the longer periods now, you're starting to see a pretty big difference between large and small. The S&P was up about 1.75% over the trailing 1 year, whereas the Russell 2000 was down almost 10% over that same period of time. So very leadership position from larger stocks. International stocks underperformed U.S. stocks once again, and that was despite the fact that the dollar weakened. So when you look at a local currency basis, I think EFO was down almost 6.5%. When you convert it back to dollars, it was down 3%. So international stocks were aided by a weaker dollar, but certainly still continued to underperform. The one change in the international market was the emergence of emerging markets, or the reemergence. You can see that was actually the best part of the global equity market during the quarter. You can see emerging markets was up 5.75%. When you look out over the year, you still see pretty bleak numbers across the international stock market indices. Emerging markets, even with the strong quarter, down almost 12% over the last year. In the face of all this, bonds continue to kind of chug along. Shockingly, the Barclays aggregate was up 3% during the quarter. It's kind of hard to do that when your starting yield is about 2.25, but certainly when you have that risk-off period of time, bonds rallied. So the ag was up 3%. Only up 2% for the last year, which represents, you know, roughly what the yield is over that period of time, a little less than what the yield is in the ag. And then you can see the various segments. High yield in particular has struggled over the last year, down 3.75%. And then real estate. Real estate has been a great performer. The Net Creek Property Index, you can see, is up almost 12% over the last year. And certainly when we look at your results are buoyed by the fact that you have a significant amount of private real estate exposure in your portfolio. Any questions about markets, indices, anything like that?
Just a comment. I'm accustomed to the Federal Reserve being the major risk. They seems like they've done a pretty good job of being transparent, and they don't seem to be the source of a lot of surprises anymore. Is that a fair assessment?
I don't know. You probably get different opinions from different people on that. I think, you know, they certainly moved a long time ago to a policy to try to be as transparent as they can. But, I mean, if you look at the last year, and the markets have reacted very differently to little pieces of Fed information. And it doesn't seem like there's even a united house within the Fed, depending on which, whether Yellen has a view versus some of the other board members. And so there's still, my sense is that there's still a little anxiety. I think it seems like the markets recognize that, based on some comments, that they're likely to move in June. The market's kind of priced that in now. But before that period of time, that there's still a lot of uncertainty as to when and how much. So I'll turn you to page 11. We'll just take a quick look at asset allocation. I know your packages have more current information than this, but this is just a snapshot of your asset allocation at the end of March. We show three pie charts here. The upper left is your actual asset allocation. Your kind of shorter or intermediate term policy is in the middle, and then your longer term strategic policy is on the right. And the big difference between those two, and the reason we have them depicted here, is that there's a big difference in the alternatives allocation, as you can see. You last year adopted a target to alternatives of 12.5%, but given the fact that some of those strategies are liquid and it's going to take time to build that out, we needed to create a more interim policy to represent what your asset allocation looks like currently. And so if you look at the table at the bottom, you'll see where your actual weightings are relative to your targets. And the real takeaway here is you're slightly underweight in public equities, and you're slightly overweight relative to that interim target in alternatives and opportunistic. You have no target to opportunistic investments, but you have almost a 2% position in opportunistic investments. So alternatives are starting to creep up. I think that's a question that's come up at some past OIC meetings. You're up to 4%, and slowly that over time will get closer to that 12.5% target. And we'll continue to adjust the interim target as we move towards the longer-term strategic target. Performance is on the next slide, slide 12 or slide 65. So we show the returns of all the asset classes, the benchmarks, and then the total fund return at the bottom. You can see that the total fund was up about 1% during the quarter. And then when you scan up the column, you can see where that came from. Public equities in aggregate were up about 30 basis points, which is in line with the index. Both domestic and international were in line with their respective indices for the quarter. Fixed income up 1.66, which slightly trailed the index for the quarter. Real estate, strongest performer as an asset class for the quarter, up 4.2%. And private equity up 0.5%, with negative returns from alts and opportunistic for the quarter. Again, those are small allocations, so they don't have much of an effect on the total fund return. When you look out over the last year, the fund is up 0.75%. And again, when you look up on the page, you can see where the sources of those come from. International equity, strong performer. Private equity, strong performer, especially relative to the public markets. Real estate has underperformed its benchmark, but in absolute terms has been a good performer. So when we look at performance versus your peer group, one of the things that you always need to take away from that is that when you compare yourself to peers, the biggest driver in the rankings and the relative returns versus your peers is going to be your asset allocation. As you know, you have a pretty heavy allocation to real estate and alternatives. So when we look at the results for the last year, even though your return is modest at 0.75%, you slightly underperformed your benchmark, you look good versus your peers. because you have more of stuff that's done well. For the last 3 years, you've compounded at 7%. For 5 years, at 7.4%. Both of those are okay returns, but slightly below your long-term targeted return of 7.5%, given the environment that we've been in. Again, real estate and private equity have been the leaders over that period of time. And then for the last 10 years, you're compounding at a little less than 6%. The next page, page 13, shows those peer rankings.
John, can we interrupt one sec? Yeah. Steve, what period do we think about the assume rate? Is it the 10-year or the 20-year?
20. It's a 20-year assumption. Mm-hmm. A lot of what gets reported to you, like last year when we were doing this asset allocation study, a lot of that is 10-year numbers. And when we go to the PERS board, we expand those to 20-year. Milliman gives us 20. We ask Callan for a 20-year number to look at a longer term. Mm-hmm. And if you look at, probably more than you wanted to know. If you look at Milliman's projections, for example, a lot of that gain comes in the back end of the 20-year projection to get to the 7.5%.
Mm-hmm. Back end like a long time ago.
Never mind. Back end meaning, no, but I mean is looking forward, years 11 to 20 are where you see kind of a rise in expected returns. Hopefully after we get out of this low-rate environment.
So wait, okay, I guess I'm asking a more basic question. So you're saying you use 20-year projections.
Right.
But we are looking at 10-year historicals, right, to help us. So how do we, I've forgotten how we reconcile those two.
Really good crystal ball.
The 10-year trailing performance with the 20-year projection,
well,
is that you?
The 7.5% return expectation over that long period of time is based on forward-looking. It's not based on what's happened in the past. I mean, certainly we look at the past as a guide. We certainly want to understand economic conditions. But both the actuary and consultants are trying to project returns going forward. The difference, I think, that Steve's pointing out is that our projection period is 10 years. I think that's pretty common for consultants, whereas the actuary is looking at 20, 30, 40 years, which is really a better indication of what the liability stream looks like.
Okay, and the magic happens after 10 years, which is sort of where the investment consultants are.
I think that was the real takeaway, is that the next 10 years are challenging as you look out in terms of expected returns,
so
but that 7.5 is still reasonable over a longer period of time. As an assumed rate of return, recognizing again that I think we're not alone in thinking that the capital market environment will be challenging over the next 5 to 10 years.
So if we think the next 10 years are going to be challenging, why do we think the 10 years following that are going to be so much better?
Not to speak on
because we won't
know
what's going to happen. Kick the can down the road like they've been doing for the last 30 years.
I think the presumption is, again, at some point we get back to normal. At some point the central banks resume actually charging for money rather than all the elements that they're doing now to try to stimulate the economies. And Jim, please bail me out.
If you say so, that sounded good. I think that's certainly part of it. I think there's an expectation that, you know, rates will normalize, whatever that means. You also have to recognize that you brought the expected return down from 7.75% to 7.5%. So I think there's a recognition that
from 8. Actually,
so
from 8,
so is the is the elephant in the room that we really don't want to lower it to what we think the reality is going forward? Is that like what we're saying, is that we really think it should go to 3.5 or 4, but we don't want to have to actually, you know, deal with the reality?
Well, there's certainly implications if you were to lower your.
Yeah, I understand that, but again, I'm just saying,
right,
if we think that 11 through 20 is the good times, based upon nothing other than, you know, fantasy islands out there, we just...
Two things I need to acknowledge. One, I called you John, and I know your name is Jim. I'm sorry.
Okay.
You can call me some other name.
They call
name.
Way worse.
And then I kind of took the stinky genie out of the bottle with that question, but I just continue to not understand how...
Well, because you're going to be paying bills.
Yeah, how we're pinched at 1%. We see 10 years back at 6.5%, 7%, and then assume going forward 8%. I don't know. I'm not that smart.
Well, we assume going forward 7.5%, and I can provide for you the 20-year projections, what I meant, and that's from Milliman in November. What I meant as far as an increase is not from 3 or 4 up to something. It's more like we chug around 6.5, 7 for a couple of years until we start gradually climbing to something more like 7, 6, 20 years out. So it's a very even look. But then they also do a stochastic model that shows you how big the candlesticks get around the variability of that expectation. And the longer you go out, obviously, the bigger those get.
Okay, sorry, Jim. I know you have nothing to say about that.
It's an important question, and it's something that...
Well, and then we have all that negative makeup from the years that we weren't hitting.
Well, when you ask, and as I often am, why are we at a $20 billion UAL? You look at that 10-year number, and that's a big contributor.
I'm being stinky.
There's a couple other things that I would just point out as part of that, too, is I think a lot of the takeaway is, you know, you look at... we run a, you know, sort of some sort of optimization, and we show you a portfolio, and it says you're not going to get to 7.5. And the takeaway is we're not going to get to 7.5. That's really not what it says. It says the probability of getting to 7.5 over that period is less. It's still a reasonable probability. I think it's 43% or something like that in terms of how that works. So it's not impossible to get there, number one. Number two, we're assuming a lower inflation rate over the intermediate period of time than what you're assuming over that longer period of time. So there's an actuarial gain from that. So the real return expectation, even if the nominal return expectation on the portfolio is less than the 7.5, the real return expectation is actually greater than what's expected over the long term. So there should be a gain there. And the other thing is when we're using assumptions for asset classes, there's no premium baked into that. We're using pretty modest assumptions based on asset class performance, based on indices, what we expect to happen from the indices. So if you get anything from active management, which over time has worked, especially in your alternative asset classes, that'll help. So those are other factors that are important as part of that, but it's still a question, as it's challenging.
Yeah, I understand the wiggle, but we're wiggling the wrong way.
Can I ask a fundamental question? Is it my understanding that our information is informative to PERS, not definitive? We don't define what PERS assumes, do we?
Well, there's...
Now you've done it. Now you've done it, bud.
There's, you're either the chicken or the egg, and I can't really tell you which one you are.
That's your attitude, man.
At least in this last exercise, Catlin led the way in setting an assumption through June of 2015, because you did a rather extensive asset allocation review, and that yielded some changes in how you decided to target their portfolio going forward. That reallocation then meant that the PERS board had a different set of circumstances to look at than they had 2 years prior to that, because you're changing the mix slightly. It results in a different projection going forward. The PERS board sets the assumed rate. That's their job, but it is heavily informed and guided by what Callan does predominantly as general consultants to the OIC, as well as what Milliman does with their own their own proprietary investment projections. There's a variance there. Our actuaries walked us through the decision-making. We ended up more on the Callan end of the range, because that's where the PERS board ended up. But it is their job to set the assumed rate, yes. Heavily influenced, guided, boundary by what the investment council does in its asset allocation study.
Good.
So we have that conversation with the PERS board in November, or late in the year?
We're having another conversation in August. The PERS board won't look at the assumed rate again until next summer. They do it in the odd number of years.
Okay. You're all happy.
Sorry, Jim.
No, I was going to stop there, actually.
You had enough fun?
Don't dare say anything more.
Okay. Any other questions? Thanks, Jim.
Thanks.
Aren't you happy that you delegated that one?
We stood behind. We were standing here behind him, though.
You're backing up. You feel that more support.
All right. So, based on feedback from last quarter's report, I present version 2 of the list dashboard. Still using the same output from Aladdin, but hopefully in a more concise format. It's still an evolving document, so obviously still welcome any feedback or requests for more content. I know Katie had mentioned earlier that you were looking for something specific or maybe an Aladdin Lite platform to play with.
Yeah.
That's not available, but to the extent that I can create a simple report for you, certainly let me know and I'll try to do that.
Thanks, bro.
Turning over to page 2, two stack bar charts. Hopefully this is fairly self-explanatory. Dollar allocations on the left and risk contribution to total risk on the left with the colors arranged representing different asset classes. Slide 3 shows the same information scaled up to 100%. Really the interesting takeaway on this slide is fixed income in dark blue represents 20% of NAV of OPERF, but it contributes almost nothing to the risk of the plan. The slides later in the dashboard will provide some explanation as to why that's the case.
That's a good thing, right?
That's a good thing, yes. Slide 4 provides more detail on the risk contribution for OPERF and individual asset classes broken down by risk factor groups. As a refresher, Aladdin's risk model is built on the assumption that the returns of an investment can be explained by that investment's characteristics or exposures to risk factors. During the discussion on last quarter's report, there was a question asked about what makes up the alternative risk factor group. And I think the word idiosyncratic was used that may not have to clarify the matter. I'm hoping to try to do a better job with this slide. The alternative risk factor group really is a pretty broad range of private equity, real estate, and hedge fund factors such as economic sector, property type, and commodity type. But more specifically, what is private equity is really very much public equity risk factors, just with a different label. So they're really not that idiosyncratic. And so to call that out in this report, I essentially remapped the alternative factors in the private equity asset classes as regular equity, which is why private equity is almost all equity exposure and not quote-unquote alternative. What's left are just the real estate and alternative real estate and hedge fund factors, which remain still this very broad bucket that's still in purple. But ultimately, though, if you look at the far left stack bar chart, and I think it just, again, reflects our intuition that equity risk is really the biggest risk driver of OPERF. So it's about 85% of the total risk contribution. Fixed income, you can see, is now the risk contribution mainly comes from rates, which is the dark blue. And the next two slides show essentially why fixed income now is a better diversifier for broker. So turning over to slide 5.
Were you surprised by how minimal our foreign exchange risk country? Were you surprised at all about the foreign exchange?
Not so much. The way I think it's kind of getting in the weeds, the way equity is represented, and most of the foreign exchange comes from equities, public equity basically. And they take some in as currencies, some of the risk as country risk, and some as just standard market risk or value risk or size risk. So they really, I think, meaning the Latin modelers really decompose foreign exchange from country risk.
Got it. Is there a way to do you actually look at country risk as a risk factor?
So specifically
brought out somewhere.
It is not in this report, but it can be brought out later on. And certainly, right now, a member of Treasury is looking at foreign exchange risk.
So if I wanted to look at exposure to the euro, there's two ways to look at that then, right? There's the currency risk, and then there's the equity in the euro zone, if I can use that term. Can you break it out that way?
It can be broken out that way,
great.
Yes.
Yeah. That's phenomenal.
And
great.
I will add that next slide. So turning over to slide five, back in December, the OIC approved a strategic rebalance of the fixed income portfolio from short-term corporates to long-duration treasuries. And I think slide five is a great example of Aladdin's real-time analytics. It shows essentially that the rebalance occurred through the month of February, as you see that the contribution, risk contribution from spreads in light blue declined through February, while those from rates increased throughout that month. And turning over to slide six, it shows that because of the strategic rebalance from spreads to rates, the ex-ante holdings-based risk correlation of fixed income to OPER declined from 0.45 to 0.02. The exact number doesn't matter, but it essentially reflects that now fixed income is a better diversifier of the total plan. And less significantly, if you look at real estate versus OPERF, the correlation picked up slightly. So it went from 0.6 to effectively 0.8. Now, most of that really is driven by the fact that last quarter was a more volatile quarter for public equities and REITs, which increased the correlation of real estate to total plan. But you know, as the real estate team implemented their strategic rebalance of allocating more to core, we should see that correlation decrease. And maybe to torture John's rock band analogy, maybe the real estate team was playing the bass on the higher number of frets and sounding a lot like a rhythm guitar, and now over time we're here to play more of a bass. So anyway, sticking a fork in that dead horse analogy. slide seven, there's really nothing specific to call out. It's just a reduced set of scenarios. The idea is that in the future, topical scenarios could be added to this report. And finally, slide eight. Liquidity is obviously a risk that the board for board's consideration. This Aladdin's liquidity analytics is really more focused on public markets instruments, and so it's not really appropriate for OPERF. So in this report, which I was thinking also doing something for currencies and possibly country, is just showing on the left-hand side the approximate period to liquidate various OPERF allocations. And on the right-hand side are essentially the liquidity demands on OPERF, liquidity liabilities as well. But this is an evolving report, and in the future it may be turned into an indicator, or I may just volatilely adjust the liquid investments to get a better sense of what is available liquidity in a stressed market environment.
Carl, this is really interesting.
I know.
Yeah.
So where you have, under the liquidity report, where you have it like the infinity sign.
Yes.
So you just totaled up our private equity commitments, real estate, alternatives, opportunity, but then the uncalled commitments are negative.
So that is a demand, a future demand on cash from the plan.
So what's the one on the left?
Under infinity is our actual, if you look at our net asset value, that's actually what we have on the books, about $24 billion-ish in illiquid private market investments.
That could be called, or
that
happened?
That has already been called.
Oh,
and has been invested.
Okay, got it. Okay.
And the $13 billion negative is future.
That's what I was confusing. Okay.
So the combination of slides 7 and 8 lead me to think about my day job, where I'm pinched on cash flow because of difficulty in equities markets returns. So I know there's a team of smart folks who help you manage cash. I think we've talked about this before. But if you are doing the scenario analysis on slide 7 and you see the liquidity, even if it's an inadequate liquidity snapshot, what's the process internally for thinking about how you might respond in these different situations given the analytics that you have for liquidity?
That's a great question, and that's something that I think we need to develop. At this point, what I've shown on page 8 is, no haircutting at all for volatility. And it may make sense that, we should have a scenario where it's a terrible equity market. We still want to rebalance back into equity, but we still have to make pension payments and make capital calls. How the process for that... I would say at this point we haven't necessarily written down on paper, but that's something that we're sort of thinking about and have a processes on the shelf ready to go in that kind of environment.
Yeah, it sounds like just taking what we've heard from Callan and from Steve, that the next, let's say, 5 to 7 years may be difficult times, and we see what the stress scenario might be, it almost feels like it's time to have a conversation about what we'll do about cash if you know, we remain flat. I don't know, does that sound... Are you thinking about that right now, John, or... It feels like strategically it's ripe.
Yes, and we've been thinking about it, we've been talking about it, we've reflected in the previous asset allocation iteration, which had a meaningful component of fixed income, high quality, short duration for that express purpose. But of course, there's an opportunity cost to that in terms of yield, but more importantly, you give up the diversification benefit in a deflationary environment of being longer and having the rate sensitivity. And so when we got back together with Callan last year, we decided that at the margin, the diversification benefit of duration was more important to us than the liquidity element of having that short piece. Mm-hmm. And that's the trade we made. Recognizing that we've got inflation sensitivity in real estate and building inflation sensitivity in the alternatives. So we've covered the inflation sensitivity. We now got the deflation sensitivity. And so now you're circling back. So it's like whack-a-mole. Now you're circling back to what did we give up? Well, we gave up some liquidity.
Now, I leave to your judgment what we need to do. I feel like, as a board member, I don't understand the strategic framework for thinking about liquidity in the distress scenarios that we've seen, and whatever judgments you make, you know, you're the expert, we'll respect those, but I don't have a sense that I understand.
But that's exactly the right question, because we, the senior leadership team of the investment division and Callan and Alan, we got together 3 times, and one of the most important elements of that conversation was, can we give up some of our liquidity to go against deflation, to go up against a deflationary scenario better by having more duration? And the answer was yes. But it's a judgment call.
So you want to understand what that protocol is.
That's right.
That Carl's talking about, that he's going to define and pull off the shelf if the market's...
I'm reluctant to make it mechanistic.
Yeah,
no, just general. I mean, an overview protocol or whatever.
But this is really, I mean, this is right on the heart of the issue.
Right.
Can I just make a comment? Just to look at it a little bit of in a different way, the target for the fixed income portfolio was changed at the same time all of this was decided on a broad asset allocation basis. And part of that was to introduce a treasury allocation, a dedicated treasury allocation. So yes, there's duration there, and yes, there's price risk there, but there's nothing really more liquid than treasuries. And if you get into a stressed environment, especially if risk assets are selling off, likely those assets are going to be going positive, and you're going to have a lot of liquidity in them. So to the extent you need to rebalance and have liquidity, your fixed income portfolio is actually more liquid now because you've reduced the below investment grade and increased the trading liquidity of the portfolio. So just a different way of thinking about liquidity.
Isn't an example of that on page 7 of the scenario analysis, 2011 U.S. downgrade, mm-hmm. where you see the fixed income being a positive contributor in that downgrade?
That's right, yes.
And there is duration, but it doesn't mean you have to hold on to it.
Right.
You could rebalance your portfolio.
And those are likely the two asset classes you'd be rebalancing, fixed income to equity.